Hello, and welcome to another UK Column interview. Now, many of you share your stories with us, and some of them are so powerful that we have to speak to you directly so that you can tell your story. And today, that's no exception. Over the last 4 years, we've reported on many tragic stories of your loved ones who have either gone into hospital or have been in care homes and have been abused, neglected, and have died in horrifying circumstances. Stories that we should never be hearing. As many of you will know, I am a retired state registered nurse. And whilst I trained back in dinosaur years ago, and we didn't get everything right back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. We didn't. But it was never like this. We were never hearing the stories that we're hearing today. And today is a very special day because it's one of our own family that wrote to us. This is Hilary Baltrop, and she's come to talk to us about her mum, Lois. She's bravely agreed to tell her story because she thinks it needs to be heard, and it certainly does. And it's in memory of a wonderful, wonderful woman who you're about to meet called Lois. So Hilary, thank you so much for agreeing to come and talk to us, because I know that this is going to be very difficult for you because you've been on a roller coaster of emotions over the last few years and you've lost many in your family. So our huge condolences and love to you all. But welcome to UK Column, Hilary. It's really lovely to see you here.
Thank you, Debbie. It's nice to be here.
Right, Hilary, let's begin. Tell us about your mum. Tell us about all the wonderful things about your mum, because you and your mum, you are both UK Column viewers, and your mum used to love sitting down and watching UK Column with us, didn't she?
She did, and I was so surprised, but she's always been very, very up to date with everything political, and she's always had a very strong, she was the SDP, she wasn't sort of Labour or Conservative, she was sort of in the middle, and she was a big voice in the community. She went on just before she died, she actually went to some council meetings about proposing to build new houses. And I said, "You're not really going, are you?" She said, "I am." And she went on. She had a little electric scooter, and she went. And they produced the minutes, and she was named on the minutes, you know, and her voices, you know, her concerns were noted, and I was quite really proud of her. So she never gave up, even, you know, when she was really poorly. She never stopped being part of the community.
And the community was a really big deal for her, wasn't it? Because she was also a Brownie leader, am I right?
Yes, she was one of the longest serving brown owls in the country. I wouldn't like to think how many young ladies she had through Brownies over the years, but the majority of the young ladies of Otley. And so that made, she was so well known. Everybody loved her and thought the world of her. She fought all the odds to take them on pack holidays, and we went all over, and she took it very seriously. And towards the end, she was an assistant commissioner for West Yorkshire. I know she met Princess Margaret. She got an award from Princess Margaret, just because of her dedication. She was just one of those people that gave everything, and, you know, she was rewarded by the love she received from the community. When she died, of course, we were only allowed 10 people at the funeral, when the church should have been lit up. But unfortunately, It wasn't, but people came to the house and lined the street for a long way. That was so unbelievable. I didn't think people would. And to
but
drive
people
off.
They do care.
They do.
They do care, Hillary. They really do care.
But, I'm so sorry.
No, don't be. Please don't be sorry, because your mum was loved by everybody, the community, her brownies, the parents, so many people. But one thing that we haven't told our audience is that she had her fair share, didn't she, of medical problems and health issues. And before your father sadly died just a few years ago, she needed full-time care, didn't she? So when you lost your dad, you became her full-time carer. Tell us a little bit about what kind of obstacles she was having to face and what kind of care you had to give her, Hillary.
Because she'd been so ill for so long, she started with rheumatoid arthritis at 18. So she did need a lot of care. She had a full leg amputation about 20 years ago, but never held a bat. She had an artificial leg, and she was wearing it right up until about 12 months before she passed away. But all her shoulders had collapsed. They'd tried pinning them. Her neck was actually broken. Over the years, you know, from having it for so many years, the deterioration of the bones around the metalwork made her ribs had fused with her pelvis. So she was basically quadriplegic. She could just move, she could get her hands to there, and that was it. So she could have a drink with a straw, and she could just about to feed herself, and she wouldn't let anybody do anything for her that she could do herself. So yes, when my dad passed away, sadly, I was always sort of sharing it with my dad anyway before that, but then having to give up my house to move in fully to look after her, which she needed help with everything, with bathing, with dressing. But it was just, that's what we did. It was normal.
And it had been particularly difficult, I know, for you. But then tell us a little bit about a little patch you found on her scalp, didn't you? You found something on her scalp and you were a little bit concerned. When was that, Hillary?
Early May. And I was washing her hair and I felt like a little scab. And within about a week, it had grown to about the size of a penny. So I rang the GP and they asked me to send photographs. So I got my phone out, I took some photographs, sent them in. Then he did a Zoom call with my mum and she did it. You know, we did have an iPad that was assistive for her. Because she did like to go online. And she did the Zoom call with the doctor and he just said that he didn't like the look of it and she would have to go to Chapel Allerton Hospital in Leeds for it check-in. And that was what he said, for check-in. So I took her for the appointment and they actually let me go in with her to the appointment with the consultant because she was in the wheelchair. And he said, I'm going to do a punch biopsy. And I said, well, she hasn't stopped her warfarin. And he said, oh, it's okay. It'll be okay. It's just going to be a small biopsy. But I was thinking, no, this isn't right. You know, she's on blood thinners. But you believe what they say and you trust them. So they took her off and brought her back and the nurse had a hand on her head with a pad and said, oh, well, you know, you just need to keep your hand on this for a little while and then you can take her home and she'll be fine. but I couldn't stop the bleeding. So I found a nurse and she got me another pad and she put a bandage, she bandaged the pad on. By the time I got out of the ward, it was, there was just blood dripping out from the back of it. So I was having to push the wheelchair with my hand on her head, and I found some more nurses and they just said, it'll stop, just keep the pressure on. And that was it. So then as I'm going outside, I was struggling on the curbs. I mean, the drop curbs, but it's not easy. And I walked past some nurses who just looked at me as I'm struggling with a bag and my mum's bag and everything. And I just thought, oh, thanks, ladies. You know, thanks for your help. And I got her in the car and we drove home. But most of the journey home, I was trying to put pressure on her head because it was still bleeding. And I got home and after about a couple of hours of me sat with her with pressure on it, wouldn't stop, I rung an ambulance because I thought she's lost too much blood. You know, she wasn't very big. She was tiny. She only weighed 6.5 stone. And the ambulance came and they were so rude to me, as if I shouldn't have called them. And the ambulance woman just said, you just keep pressure on it. That's all you've got to do. And I said, yes, but she has lost a lot of blood. Oh, she'll be fine. If you keep pressure on it, it'll be fine. But I was the only one in the house. My mum couldn't reach her hand up to put pressure on. There wasn't anybody who could help me. So even if I went to make her a cup of tea, I'm coming back the amount of blood, it was horrific. But the ambulance woman tore the dressings off, and the bit that had actually stopped bleeding, she opened it up again and made it 10 times worse. And then they just left. And I ended up having to sleep behind my mum. She had a hospital bed in her bedroom. But you know what, the light with the sides, it wasn't very easy. Because I was terrified she was going to bleed out, that she was going to, I would wake up and she would have lost that much blood that she'd be dead.
Honestly, I'm listening to you and I know we've spoken before, but I just want to rewind a little bit because this happened in the May. Now, which year are we talking about here? We're talking
2020.
So we're in lockdown. We're in a lockdown. And I just wanted to put that into perspective for our viewers. But also, I just wanted to explain that if somebody's on warfarin, as you've said, it's a blood thinner, which would mean that blood, you could bleed, you're a bleed risk, basically. So you have to have regular blood tests when you're on warfarin to check what your clotting levels are. So the fact that this wasn't done and the fact that you were ignored is red alert number one. I'm just trying to picture you, and it's not a difficult picture to imagine, actually, because I'm sure people that are watching, if you've ever tried to push one of those hospital wheelchairs or any wheelchair with two hands, it's bad enough, right? Especially when you've got bags with you, you know, and you're not used to pushing maybe a hospital wheelchair, for example. The fact that you were trying to push a wheelchair, applying pressure because of bleeding and being allowed to leave the hospital when she was in that state and you were obviously struggling to move her, is another huge red flag. And I can't imagine how difficult that must have been. You get her home, the hospital beds are high, then it's not like having a normal bed in your bedroom. A hospital bed is it's much higher than normal beds. And you can't just lie on the floor next to a hospital bed and have your arm up and apply pressure. So, I mean, the fact that you had to do that was outrageous. That should never have happened. The ambulance crew, I mean, taking a pad off when you know that somebody's bleeding like that and you have got some form of scab that's starting to form or some form of clot is just, in my opinion, as a nurse, irresponsible. So I just wanted to set the scene for people that are watching of how outrageous and wicked that this was. So I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Hilary, but let's go back then to the ambulance. The ambulance have gone now and left your mum with you, still bleeding even more. What happened next?
It was just, that was the day till I got her to bed. I was just pressure on it. A lot of the blood had dried and was matted, and that's what the ambulance woman had pulled off. And I said, you know, this needs cleaning. And she said, well, clean it. That was how she was with me. She was, there was no care or anything. She was quite cocky. So after she'd gone, I bathed it, and I had to cut some of her hair. It was just too matted. And obviously it was painful. You know, she was in pain with it. So I cut some of the hair away and I redressed it and keeping pressure on it. And that's what I did all day until I got her to bed. And like I say, all the time I'm thinking, this isn't right. She's losing too much blood. You can't function, you know, losing this much blood.
Hilary, you were thinking also you were worried about infection as well at that point.
Absolutely. I had saline and quite a lot of, you know, quite a good medication kit that I'd collected over the months, well, over the years. And I had everything to clean it, which I did, but it's not good enough. I was worried that obviously her immune system was shot. It was only about 12 months previous that she'd had pneumonia, and I've had sepsis myself and I know the signs. And straight away I was thinking this could go the wrong way. And I was worried, which in fact that is the way that it did go.
Tell us, Hilary, because you called it very early. So most people would think, well, you ring the hospital, you ring the ambulance, you ring a doctor and you get help. What happened for you and what happened for your mum?
I realised after, it was a few days later, she was fine for a few days and then she started to deteriorate. She said that she didn't want to get dressed, which for my mum, she got dressed every day, you know, without fail. However bad she felt, even if she wasn't going anywhere, she would get dressed. But she said, and that's how I knew that she wasn't herself. And I was giving her a breakfast and she sort of had a bit of a wobble. And I thought, that's it. I'm ringing an ambulance. I rang 999 and the ambulance came pretty quickly. And it was a girl, the ambulance lady was a girl I went to school with. And so I was, you know, quite pleased with that, because I knew her. She was lovely and she was lovely with my mum. And she was saying, look, we have to take her in, but, you know, don't worry, she'll be fine. And I said, okay, well, I'm a carer. She needs me for everything, for medication, for drinks, everything. And I'm coming with her. And she says, no, you're not. I'm sorry, you can't come in the ambulance. So I said, okay, I'll follow. I'll follow you down in my car and I'll meet you there. She went, no, you can't. You can't come. She says, give it an hour and ring. My mum was sat in the chair that they put her in the ambulance, and she was saying, Hilary, can you remember to do this? And will you ring around to Margaret? And she was fine. I knew she was poorly, but I knew I'd caught, if it was sepsis, I knew that I had caught it quick enough. I thought I had. And the girl that that took her was she was, you know, like I say, she was lovely with her. So I thought, right, okay, I'll do what they say. I'll give it an hour and then I'll ring. And that's what I did.
And where was your mum? Did anybody know where your mum was?
Well, they told me they were taking her to the LGI, which is Leeds General Infirmary. So that is where I rang. And I was told it was too early. They didn't know she'd been booked in yet. Told me to ring at lunchtime because it was about 9 o'clock in the morning when she went, about 9:15. And so I left it till about 11 and I rang again and I said, has she had a medication? Has she had a drink and has she been to the toilet? Because these are all things she can't do on her own. And is she on a trolley? That was my main concern, was if she was on a trolley, because my mum's ribs had fused to her pelvis. So if she was sat for a long time, it stopped her from breathing. She was, you know, it would really make her breathless. So she had to, be laid flat, or not flat, but you know what I mean. And the woman couldn't tell me anything. And she said, she'll be fine. Don't worry about her. And I said, I'm coming down because I want to make sure that she's all right. And she said, no, you can't come down. We're not allowing anybody in. I said, please, please let me see her. She said, no, if you come down, we'll have you arrested. So I thought, right, okay, I'll give it a bit longer. About 2 o'clock, I rang again and she said, we don't know where she is. We think she's being moved to St. James's Hospital. But we're not sure. I says, what do you mean you're not sure? She says, well, she's not being booked in at here and or at St. James's. She says, you might be best ringing St. James's. So I rang there. They didn't know. I rung the woman back. I says, I am coming down. I want to know where she is. She said, again, she said, we'll have you arrested. Security will be waiting for you and you will not get in the building. I was frantic and I just didn't know what to do. I felt so helpless. All I wanted was to see her and they wouldn't let me. And then about 6 o'clock, I got a phone call to say that she said, we found her. She's okay. She's been admitted to a ward. She's in a side room and she's okay. So I said, right, I want to come and see her. And she said, no, you can't. So what I did was I rang the ward and I said, I want to know what's happened. And she said, she's okay, but couldn't tell me if she'd had anything to eat, been to the toilet, or anything. All she kept saying was, she's all right and she's settled. So I said, you know, can I come and see her? No, you can't come and see her. So I had to leave it. I was stumped. I didn't know what to do. All I wanted to was to go down. That was my instinct. But because they kept saying she's fine, she's settled, don't worry, I took that, I believed it. That was at about 6:30. It was tea time. And then at about 9:30 in the evening, I got a phone call. And it was a doctor who said, I'm very sorry, but your mother has passed away. And the first thing she said, would you like to come and see her? So I did. I went straight down. And they said that it was that it was sepsis. But I didn't ask. questions I should have asked at that time. And that is a big regret. All the questions I wanted, you know, why, how, everything. I wasn't able to ask them at that time. And like I said, that is a big, big regret. But I was on my own. I think both kids were working away at the time. And it was just a shock.
You know, Hilary, I just want you to take a breath for a minute, because I'm just trying to imagine the shock that you must have been in. Because your mum went in the ambulance, and when your relatives go in an ambulance, the first thing that you want to do is go with them or follow the ambulance. So you're there with them. That's the natural reaction. But you weren't allowed to do that. And you had to rely on trust. Trust in the ambulance crew, trust in the receiving medical team. But they lost her. They lost your mum. They didn't even know which hospital she was in. I cannot even begin to think how you must have felt alone, with no support. And then to be told so many times and threatened with arrest, but to be told that you couldn't go and see your mum when she was alive, when you needed her and she needed you, is heinous, it's wicked, and it's cruel. And you're not alone, because we've spoken to other people who have lost relatives and haven't been allowed to see them in their last days and hours of life. But yet, the minute they have passed, all of a sudden the relatives are invited in to see their loved one when they've passed, but nothing's different, nothing's changed. So the big question arises is, what happened from the time that she went into the ambulance to the time she died? And also, I think the big question is why? Why were you not allowed to see her? Why were you threatened with arrest twice, not allowed to see her, and yet told to go and see her when she'd passed? I cannot even begin to imagine the shock. And, you know, one of the reasons that we were doing this interview today is not just to honour and tell Lois's story, but also to highlight the grief and that question, Hilary, that you've asked me so many times when we've spoken: could I have done more? Should I have done more? Did I ask the right questions? You were in shock. Anybody that goes through an experience like that is in shock. And I doubt anybody would be able to ask the pertinent questions at the pertinent time. But I do find that a lot of people are saying that they wish they'd have done more, and they're beating themselves up. And actually, there was nothing. You did absolutely everything that you could. But you did go to the hospital, didn't you? You went down to the hospital. And I believe there was a bit of a problem with the death certificate. Tell us what happened after you received that dreadful phone call, Hilary.
Well, I went straight down, and I was met by a doctor. And I knew that they were putting deaths down as COVID that weren't COVID related, and I knew that, you know, she didn't have COVID. And one of the nurses had said something about COVID death. So I said to this doctor, I says, if you dare put COVID on her death certificate, I will sue your backsides. And was just, you know, met with a sort of astonishment. But the death certificate was issued with pneumonia and sepsis as the cause. And then I was told that it was sepsis, that it went, and when sepsis occurs, it happens very, very quickly. And I thought, well, yes, but if you'd have put her on IV antibiotics when she'd have got there at 10 o'clock in the morning, there wouldn't have been a problem. Then, obviously, afterwards, I'm thinking, I bet she never got a drink. I bet she never got to go to the toilet or anything to eat. And these are all questions that now I'm, well, obviously I've been beating myself up about, but I want to know the answers. And they're going to tell me, I'm going to request the medical records and find out why they lost her, what happened. And I was told that I wasn't allowed to see her because she wasn't imminent, death wasn't imminent, that only relatives of people whose loved ones were dying then could go. And that's why they were refusing me, because they said she, you know, like I said, her death wasn't imminent. So I was told that when she died, that somebody was with her. This woman was on the phone, was saying, you don't need to worry because she had somebody with her when she passed away. So if she had somebody with her, why couldn't that be me? Why couldn't they have just got on the phone and said, we think it's imminent, get here, even if it had not got there in time, but to have that choice, to know that some random person she never had even met held a hand at that final moment. I'll never forgive them for that.
No, and it should have been you. Should have been you holding her hand. Back in my day, Hilary, when I started to train, the mantra we were taught right from the get-go was TLC. And TLC stands for tender loving care. And we had charts at the bottom of patients' beds. And if there were patients in the hospital that didn't have as many visitors as others, we would have an extra TLC on the bottom of their chart so that every time we were passing, we would stop, we would have a chat. What saddens me more than anything is there doesn't seem to be any TLC going on in hospitals or care homes that I'm hearing about.
There was no notes on the end of the bed for me to look at, because that's what would have been the first thing I did. Because when my dad was in hospital, it's what I did every day. And there wasn't the clipboard, you know, at the end of the bed. There wasn't even her name on a thing above the bed.
That's all gone. And that's one of the big issues that we have now, in that in my day, patients would have charts on the bottom of their beds. But of course, we're going to digitalization now. So there's nothing for relatives to look at the bottom of the bed to see when their relatives last had a drink, what their temperature is, what their blood pressure is, all those vital signs that relatives used to be able. I mean, the relatives, family and friends were the regulators in our day. When the doors opened at 2 o'clock for visiting, it was the friends and family that would come to us if there was a problem or a question. So when we were in lockup, because it was never a lockdown, it was a lockup. When we were in lockup, we didn't have you. We didn't have family and friends visiting because you weren't allowed to. And we still are now finding out what is going on and what went on behind closed doors. And indeed, what is still going on, because people are still going into hospitals and care homes and having the most dreadful care and the most dreadful treatment. We were always taught that when we were doing our ward rounds, we'd go around the ward at least once an hour, one of us, you know, we would always be on the ward. The patients would always see us and we would check on our patients. We'd make sure that they had a drink. We would make sure that they were comfortable. But that didn't happen to you or to your mum. And I think what struck me most is so many of our viewers that are going through similar and have gone through similar. And what I'm gathering from you, Hilary, is this guilt. We're talking 4 years on from you losing your mum, and you still have more questions than answers. And I guess one of those questions must be, was the fact that when she went into the ambulance, she was chatting, she was telling you to ring Auntie Margaret, she was telling you, you know, to remember to do things. And then she deteriorated very quickly. So we have no idea at this point, do we, whether she had intravenous antibiotics or any antibiotics, come to think of it.
No, and it was very interesting, the interview with Jackie Devoy, and she was explaining about the two-pronged approach of dehydration and midazolam, because whatever they did with my mum, it was rapid. You know, you don't go into hospital with sepsis, chatting away, and then die 12 hours later. You might be very poorly, but it can be treated quickly, can't it? And so this is why I need a note, because I don't know. I don't know what happened, whether it was just neglect, because if she'd been sat in a chair from 10 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night and not given the medication that she needed, because what would be the usual trope was, oh, we haven't got two nurses to administer morphine. I've had that myself when I've been in. You know, oh, we haven't got enough staff. It needs two of us to sign off on morphine. My mum was on morphine daily anyway. I sent her with her medication. They had no excuse not to give her it, but she couldn't get it out of the blister packs herself, even out of the, you know, easy to access dosset boxes that would come from the chemist. She couldn't do it. Her hands wouldn't work. So just by denying her own medication for that amount, that many hours, would have had a real dramatic effect. And I don't know if she had them. I don't know if she had a drink.
Hilary, she needed quite a lot of help too, because, I mean, you know, you've already told us that she's quadriplegic. She had an amputated leg. She found it difficult to drink. She drank through a straw, and you had to help her
manage a cup. She couldn't manage a cup. You know, even the beakers. Well, I know when she was in hospital with the pneumonia, I would see these beakers on the side, and I would say, why is that there? She can't do that. She can't get it high enough. You've got to put your head back to drink. You can't understand how to become nurses when they don't have that care. Like when you were a nurse and what it used to be like in the hospitals. And don't get me wrong, I know there are some wonderful nurses, and I'm not having a go at all nurses. I'm not. But I think they delegate so much to inexperienced, cheap agency workers. Haven't got the training, and they're there for the money. They're not there to care for the patients. And so it's understandable that these things happen.
Did you receive any support at all? And have you received any answers to any questions, any support whatsoever? I mean, we're talking this is where I want our viewers and listeners, and many of you are going to identify with this, because we're talking 4 years on and you're still waiting for answers. You're still searching. It's still a huge, huge burden on you. And it's taken its toll on you, hasn't it, Hilary, over the last 4 years?
Absolutely. And I have tried. I did try through PALS and I got no response at all. I didn't even get, we're going to deal with it or anything. And nobody contacted me. And then I didn't follow it up, which I should have done. Because it's hard now, but it was harder before. I couldn't even... think about it, you know, without getting upset. So you've got to get on with it. I just blocked it out. And it wasn't until it was a podcast that I listened to, I don't know if you're familiar with it, with Sheep Farm, two lads from Halifax, brilliant. They were saying that people was saying, stop talking about these deaths. It's done, it's gone. Get on, you know, move forward. And that was like a big slap in the face to me. And I wrote to Dominic from the podcast and I said, don't stop talking about these people. Because some of them haven't even come to terms with what's happened yet. And then I thought, I've wasted all that time. When I should have been finding out what happened, getting the medical records and finding out why they lost her. But I finally feel now that I'm ready to do that. I know I'm getting upset now and I do apologise, but I'm going to go through the LGI initially. To find out what happened, and I want the medical record, I want the notes, and what from the moment she was dropped off from that ambulance, I want to know what happened.
We will never stop talking about those that have been so badly abused and have lost their lives at the hands of the NHS. We will never ever stop talking about this. But you know, I want you, Matt Hancock, if you ever happen to watch this, Chris Whitty, Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, all of you, I want you to know what you've done to Hillary, to Lois, and to thousands and thousands of others. Because these stories that we're hearing are not stories, they're real lives, they're people. It's your mum, Hillary, your mum. And 4 years on, you're still asking, could I have done more? And I think that's what's so hurtful and so traumatizing for many people. And many people that are watching now are going to be nodding their heads and they're going to be saying exactly the same. Because there hasn't been really any time for any of you to grieve, because none of you have known the circumstances that your loved ones have died in. None of you know what happened behind closed doors during lockup. And this is still going on. And it takes a lot of bravery and courage to speak up, because we can see clearly, Hillary, that this is still very, very raw for you and that you need answers. And we will just carry on. We will carry on and trying to get answers for as many people as we possibly can, because these are events that should not ever be happening. Nobody should be dying in a hospital of thirst, from neglect, mismanagement, abuse, and pharmaceutical deaths. This should not be happening. Hillary, is there anything else you would like to tell? I know we're going to go to the last word. We will get to the last word. But is there anything else before we do that you would like to say, or you would like to tell us about your mum or anything that we might have missed out?
No, I don't think so. You said it perfectly just then. You know, I hope Matt Hancock is watching. And I think for a lot of people, not being able to say goodbye and then finding out that all the politicians broke the lockdown rules, they had no regard for them. Not that I believe that there was any major virus anywhere, but it's just one rule for one and one for another, isn't it? And that's got to stop. It's not fair.
No, it has got to stop. And the fact that you never got a chance to say goodbye, but you're speaking now, and this is for Lois. This is Lois's story. And I know that she'll be incredibly proud of you for telling her story, your story, so bravely and with so much courage. And for everybody listening, we're going to keep in contact with Hillary, and we're going to connect Hillary with other people that can help support her. And to anybody that's watching that's going through similar, if you would like to tell your story and you would like to speak to us, then please do get in contact, because everyone needs to hear these stories. Nobody's life should be lost in vain. Hillary, I think you're incredible. I don't think you could have done any more than you did. And I think your mum would be incredibly proud of you, as we are too, especially as we know that she was very aware of the agenda. She was very aware of the narrative. She used to love watching UK Column with you, so she knew what was going on. But I want to throw to you now for the last word, because I think you need a nice big cup of coffee and some rest. And on that note, Hillary, thank you so much. Thank you for emailing me. Thank you for being so brave. And it's over to you for the last word.
Well, thank you, Debbie. I do appreciate it. And if anything that I've said resonates with anybody, you know, please get in touch. You're not on your own. Lois was my mum, and she died at the age of 78. For most of her life, she was a pillar of the local community, a Girl Guide commissioner, and someone who took her civic responsibilities very seriously. She never failed to vote and fully paid her national insurance contributions for the whole of her working life to support that NHS that she strongly believed in and worked for. Sadly, the politicians she elected betrayed her, sacrificing care for profit, and the staff at the local hospital ignored her, leaving her to die alone and denying any contact from us. I cannot help but feel angry that this should have happened. My mother was one of thousands who were treated the same, yet no one has been held accountable or responsible. I'm telling her story today so that she will be remembered, and that people will realise that behind every statistic from the COVID period, there is a human tragedy. I cannot forget, and I will never forgive those responsible.